Well, this is not the typical Amandla music that you're so used to as we open our show, and that's because this week this show is curated by Feroz Manji of Dharaja Press. And as most of you know by now, a couple of times a month now, we have other people curating the show, Tana Gusey in Cape Town out of Manga Bay Media, and Feroz Manji this week. The only reason we're intervening before Feroz kicks in is just to explain that Feroz is having a roundtable discussion of a book that he just recently published called Matare, an Urban Bastion of Anti-Oppression Struggle in Kenya. And one of the people on the roundtable, unfortunately, the quality of the recording was not good enough for radio. It was very hard to understand her. So I had to edit most of what she said out, but we want to give her due recognition. It's Warimu Gatimba, and she has written a review of the book that you can find on the Dharaja Press website. So I encourage you to go to that because much of or part of what she had to say that I had to edit out is in her written book review. So Dharaja Press, Dharaja Press, and look for the book review Matare, an Urban Bastion of Anti-Oppression Struggle in Kenya. We are also going to be rounding out the end of Feroz's curated show with a little footnote by Doug and Farid. So, Doug, just how are you wrapping up the show?
Well, essentially, I was interviewing Farid on other issues. He just did a brilliant piece on why Africa should worry about NATO given what's going on in the Ukraine. And it appeared in the Review of African Press. And then we thought, well, let's talk a little soccer. And we went into the geopolitics of Qatar and the big money that is actually spoiling the game pretty seriously. More than spoiling it, it's corrupting it and making it inaccessible to people that should be otherwise have access to it. So that'll be at the end of the show. So stay tuned.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. This is Feroz Manji from Dharaja Press. Welcome to the show today. Today we're going to be meeting with comrades from the social justice movements in Kenya. And in particular, we'll be talking with Sam Gathanga Dogo and Kashepe Gashihi, Warimu Gathimba, and Faith Kasina. We'll be discussing the book that we published recently and which was launched in Nairobi last week, Matare, Urban Bastion of Anti-Oppression Struggle in Kenya. So welcome to our guests, Gathanga, Wairimu, Kasheke, and Faith. Welcome to you all. Well, perhaps we can start with just quickly, if each of you could just introduce yourselves. Shall we start with Faith?
Thank you. Greetings, everyone. I am Faith Kasina. I come from an organization called Kayole's Community Justice Center and the Social Justice Center's movement at large. Thank you.
Gasheke.
Hi, comrades. My name is Gasheke Gashehe. I'm a coordinator of Mathare Social Justice Center, and also a member of the Social Justice Center working group. And I'm a member also of Organic Intellectual Network, which was a part of the team that published Gathanga's book.
Okay. Wairimu.
Hi, everyone. My name is Wairimu, and I am a member of Mathare Social Justice Center and Organic Intellectual Network.
Welcome. An Afrofeminist, you describe yourself as.
Yeah.
Great, great. And then Gathanga.
Hello, everyone. I'm Gathanga Nwo. I'm from Rodaka Social Justice Center and part of the Organic Intellectual Network in Nairobi, Kenya. Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you for that. Those introductions. Gathanga, you're the primary author. There's a chapter there which was written together with Faith Kasina of this really interesting and I think an important book from my perspective. So perhaps we can start by you helping us understand why you decided to bring this book together and to give us an outline for people who may not yet have read it. What does it actually tell the story of? Give us a brief overview of it.
Thank you, Firoz. Thank you for the opportunity. The book, Madare, an Urban Busting of Anti-Oppression Struggle in Kenya, is a book that tries to recreate and rewrite the history of Madare that is unknown to many, that has been obliterated from our history books. A history that even the locals and the residents of Madare, some of them are not aware of the rich history that Madare has. Madare has been looked down upon by the outside community and also our citizen.
For people who are not familiar with Nairobi, what is Madare? I mean, you know, when I was young, Madare was the name of the mental hospital.
Yeah. So, Madare, this is the second largest slum in Kenya. And also, it holds the only public psychiatric hospital in Kenya. And so, Madare has been associated with the Madare Mental Hospital, which is the only national psychiatric hospital in Kenya. So, where you mentioned the name Madare to any other citizen of our country, what comes to their mind is the hospital. And for a long time, most people thought that maybe Madare, now the slum, hosts people who are mentally unstable, but that's not the truth. And it's the story that I've been trying to rewrite and to give a new perspective of what Madare is to me, because this is where I grew, and this the place that has nurtured me from my childhood up to this point. And so I felt somehow compelled to rewrite that history of Madare and its history in the struggle for social justice in Kenya. That was my compelling factor.
Why is it that you claim that Madare has been the center of anti-oppression struggles dating back from the colonial times? Is that right?
Yeah, so that's very, very correct.
Why is that the case?
If you start looking at the history of Madare, also from the colonial time, from the colonial struggle when the British when the British came to our country, you'll find that Madare was one of the regions that hosted most of the ex-soldiers from World War One, World War Two, and they used to organize in Madare. When they came back to Madare because most of them were made landless by the white settlers. So they came back to Madare, and that's where they started organizing. If you look at the history of people like Pio Gama Pinto, who was buried in City Park next to Madare slum, you find that these people are organizing in Madare. And that's why there's a road called Mau Mau Road. Mau Mau is the Kenya Freedom and Land Army that was that fought for our first liberation struggle against the colonial government. That road has been was named to Mau Mau Road because of the role that Madare played in all this struggle, mostly from around 1950s when there were Operation Anvil and Operation Job Scott. So that Madare has been organizing all this time from the colonial government. They were organizing against the colonial government, organizing the citizens, the residents, the ex-soldiers, organizing against the injustice that they found in the city. So this is the time we find that in our urban areas, also in Nairobi, the government introduced the Kipa system. They were using the IDs that to show that they were only visitors in the city, and so they were required to only stay for a certain period of time, and then they'll be taken back to their reserves. But then our African, the Kenyan people saw that this was like a systematic way of discriminating us on our own land. And that's why they started residing in these places to continue and organizing slowly by slowly. So next to Madare, on the western side of Madare, is Mutaiga. Mutaiga is an affluent area. And this is where most of the settlers lived when they came to the urban center. And I chose my history back to the area from our history, from my time, my maternal, my family came from those sites, and they were, their land was taken by the white settlers, and that's why we had to be pushed to Madare. And this has happened to our families too. So you find that during this time, our families, most of the families from Madare were living in Madare, but then their parents were working in Mutaiga. And this is where you find that Kenyans could go to those places. They could smuggle goods, muso, like things like guns, bullets, and come with them to Madare, then organize, and then those weapons will be dispatched to the Abadea Forest and Mount Kenya. So this is where the organizing of the people of Madare started. In the 1950s, the government learned of the plans that were going in Madare, organizing against the government, radicalizing the citizens that were, the residents that were living in Madare. And so the houses were raised by the colonial government because they felt threatened by this organizing that was happening. And they felt that now this was a threat to their rule in Kenya, and they had to do something. And they responded by raising down the shacks that had been built by Africans. And these were now the colonial struggle. I think it was given an impetus, I could say. By raising down, now I think Africans realized, our Kenyans in specific, realized that now all they were doing was somewhat impactful. And you find they continue organizing even after the house got trade. They never gave up. They never went back to the reserves. No, they decided to stay and continue organizing until we got to independence. That's what happened. This continued even after the second, now our first, our own government, the first Kenyatta regime came in power. We continue, the people of Madara continue organizing, according to the Moi regime, Kibaki, and even the last regime that we had of Uhuru Kenyatta. That's how Madara has been organizing all this time. But then the problem is that this history has been obliterated from books. Our history is very much documented in Kenya. We find that the history that people, our kids are reading, is not the true history of our country. And this is something that has been compelling me from time to try and come up with the right history so that the generation to come may know where we came from, where we are, and where you're headed as a country.
Right, that's really interesting. And am I right in saying that you were born in Madare?
Okay, I was not really born in Madare. I was born in the western part of the country, that's Eldoret, that's like the western, the Rift Valley. But then I came back to Madare in 1989, and that's where I found myself. So all this time, like for more than 20 years, I've grown up in Madare. Madare has been my home since 1999. But if you look at the history of my family, most of the maternal side, my mother's born in Madare, and my grandmother, you find that we've been all along living in Madare, apart from my great grandmother who were evicted from City Park and came back now to Madare.
The book contains a very interesting chapter, which Faith Kasina was involved in, and you focus there on the brutality and violence of Mathare and the police and the appalling activities of the police. I love the phrase you say, it's not a Kenya police service, but it's a Kenya police force, which I think is an important distinction to you have made. So Faith, tell us more about your chapter and why it was important for this to be included.
I think just from what Gadanga has said, coming from the slums, we faced a lot of police presence in our ghettos, because people call them ghettos, but they are our homes. But yeah, in those ghettos and slums, we faced a lot of police presence. And as we were growing up, there was a lot of criminalization. There still is. One of the reasons why I joined the Social Justice Centers movement was because of criminalization of young people from my community and extrajudicial killings and enforced disappearance. So there have been these talks about reforms at the police, reforming the police from police force to police service. Yes, but then as time goes by, we've seen only the uniform changed from navy blue to blue. Nothing really changed. There was a conversation that the police come live in, at the community, in the community where people live. But also we've seen the gap widen between the community and the police because of waking up every day and witnessing our young people being killed, and nothing really happens to those killer cops. We wake up in the morning, the killer cops that we know very well, like Mathare Rashid is well known, in Kayole Ngari is well known, and other killer cops. Like, we wake up, they kill young people, we document these cases, they are taken by IPOA, which is Independent Policing Oversight Authority. They are taken by IAU, International Affairs Unit, but we don't see much come out of it. Like, we don't witness these killer cops being arrested. So the reason why we came up to write about the unreformable police force is because we've tried these reforms, and reforms are not working. But it's been a battle since the times of 1986, when Moi was, during the Moi's regime, when he arrested people and mothers of victims, mothers of political prisoners camped at Uhuru Park to advocate that their sons be released. So we also linked that with the struggle that you're experiencing right now, that even right now, it's mothers of victims and survivors network that have come out, call out the police, the killer cops, and actually hold the government accountable and ask that these killer cops are held accountable and that their sons are given justice, you know. So the reason why we wrote this with Gadanga was we wanted to show the history that has been there in the police force, not service, because it's not a service anymore. It's not a service at all. It has never given service to the people. If anything, the police has been there to serve the interests of the state and not the interests of the people. We've also linked with it with the issues that during elections, we've seen a police being deployed in the areas that are termed as violent simply because they're not on the side of the ruling class. You know, if you're seen as the opposition, a lot of police are deployed in your area, Mathare being one of the areas that has experienced a lot of police presence during elections. And we've witnessed a lot of police violence and police brutality during after elections. So for us, the question was, who does the police serve? And are these reforms really working? Or are there even reforms in the first place? And if there are reforms, would they even work for the people? Because I don't think the service, the force works for the people at all. It's there to protect the interests of the state and the rich.
But one of the things, striking things that comes across both in your chapter and in the book as a whole, is to point out the leading role of women in the struggles that have taken place in Mathare and indeed elsewhere. Why do you think that is the case?
You know, women, these are their children. So for them, this struggle is so personal, because when they wake up, they're losing their children. And even if it's a wife, she has lost her husband. So this struggle is personal to the women for losing their children and not getting justice at all. And even when their children are killed, the friends of those children police go ahead and kill the friends of those children. So to them is the fact that they are losing a generation that they will never see. And the fact that even your son was a friend of someone else will also get killed without the police even caring whether they were innocent or not. So I think the struggle is so personal to the women, but their role has not been brought out perfectly in the history. And that's why to us, we thought that it's important that we tell the history of women in the struggle. They have been there fighting, and because this struggle has been so personal to them, you see, they camped at Hurupak until their sons were released. Like, they even went on hunger strike, you know. And right now, mothers go on demonstrations and do petitions to parliament asking that that police killings come to an end and that justice be served to their sons.
So, I mean, it's a really important point that you're making, because one of the limits of the way in which the story of the Mau Mau, the Landed Freedom Army, has been told has not been to emphasize the role that women played in that struggle. And secondly, what's linked to that is that the liberation movement is projected in most literature as being a rural and so-called Kikuyu realm. So, I mean, I'd really like to congratulate you for having pointed out both the importance of the role of women and the fact that it was in the urban centres as well that the struggle for freedom began and continues to be so. What gave rise to this book was also the important role that, and as often happens with Gashake, in the background, without taking credit for his role in it. Gashake, tell us more about what made you help stimulate the development of this book, and the role that it plays for the social justice centers in Kenya.
Thank you very much, Comrade Feroz, and it's very inspiring to have Gathanga, Wairimo, and Faith, who are on their own right key leaders now shaping up the social justice movement. And as you know, what sparked this book is because Gathanga has been part of the Ruaraka Social Justice Center, and being a graduate from a university, he was always questioning why there is no more history about the struggle of Mathare. And after reading a few books and also reading the literature and articles that you are writing with him, and a dialogue we had, he said that it was important as our generation to start documenting our history. So after formation of the Organic Intellectual Networks, Adanga was concerned that our generation was not writing our history. We were just reading about the books of Mainawa Kenyatta and many history written during Mau Mau, and there was nothing written about the role of the urban struggle of places like Mathare. And in his history, being grown up in Mathare, and there was always that narrative that Mathare was dispossessed people, hopeless, and they were victims. And he said that when he read some history about Pio Gama Pinto, and it's that book of Pinto that sparked this heavy conversation, after knowing that Pinto used to supply Mau Mau freedom fighters with the ammunition and tools for writing petition and memorandum against the oppression of the peasant in Kenya. So he said, how comes many people don't know about the role of Mau Mau, the role of Pinto, the role of Mau Mau Road in Mathare? And that's what sparked this conversation after him writing few reflections. Then as you know, Feroz, you inspired me in writing. I remember I can tell these young people. I used to write very few paragraphs. Then you said, this is very important. Continue writing with Pambazuka. They should know that you had a publication called Pambazuka, where some of us cut our teeth in writing. And that was very powerful. And that's when I started sharing some of his articles with you, and we encourage him to write. But the spark is that in the last 30 years, where we have been facing the the liberal democratic diet. Little has been written about social movements and the role of the ordinary people in the struggle for liberation, even the role of the Mathare in multi-party democracy, the role of Mathare in building up in the new constitution. Very little have been written, and that was the concern. And not only Gathanga that is concerned with that, but many other young people also are concerned with that, that we have not written about the history of our struggle in the last 30 years.
You made mention of the organic intellectual network. Can you say a little bit more about that? I don't think many people in our audience necessarily know about who those are. We've lost Gashake. Well, maybe I can ask Gathanga to say a little bit who are the organic intellectuals and why are they organic intellectuals?
Okay, thank you for this opportunity. I think I talk a little bit and then Werimu will also help on some aspect. Maybe you will forget. So, okay, Mathare being the second slum, okay, there's been this issue about my story about slum tourism. People come to study Mathare for their academic studies, they do their researches, and then they go back to their places. So we always thought that it was good that if you could nurture writers or intellectuals from the community, people who have been in our communities, people who have experientially known our slums and the struggles they've been going through. And that's why we call them organic, because they've experientially been through the various challenges of Mathare, such as access to water, access to the challenges of access to health, the environmental and ecological injustices, deaths of judicial killing. That's why we thought that coming up with people who truly know and who have experientially lived this life will try and at least give a clear and a vivid picture of how their struggles have been. And that's why we call them organic, because they've been living with us and they still experience these challenges day by day. So it's not something like they're not writing from the academic angle that we know. So we write from our experiences. That's why we are called organic intellectuals.
Okay. And Faith, you're part of the organic intellectual network?
Yes.
So tell us why.
I think just for the fact that it gives platforms to people who are not like writers, you know, renowned writers, to tell their stories as authentically as they can in whatever language they feel best. That is a powerful thing, because then it's only in our language that we understand and we can tell our stories. So when you get such a place where you can tell your story as powerful as you want and in whatever language you feel fit, and people are able to impress it, it's a powerful thing, because then you don't have to like fit in a certain bracket for you to be told you're a writer, you know. That's impressing our talent and who we are and dignifying the ghetto talent and writers.
But the book that you put together was written in English. Might we see some books appearing in Sheng as well?
We might see books in Swahili. Sheng is kind of very tricky because the Sheng keeps changing all the time. And when you come to Kayole, we will not understand our Sheng. You know, it's only the people of Kayole that can read the Sheng in Kayole, and Mathare people cannot read our Sheng. But we are trying to tell our stories in a simple language, and maybe we can even translate Gathanga's book in Swahili, the language that the people of Mathare can understand better. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the point you make that it's a growing, it's constantly changing. That's what language should be. That's what language does. When it gets fossilized by academics to say this is the Queen's Swahili, then actually it restricts and then creates a division between those who speak and those who are supposedly the thinkers. And I think, you know, I should, you should not lose sight of the movement and motion of language, and the appropriation of and the creation of something new. And I think that's something to celebrate. We can always put a parallel translation if necessary, but I think we should experiment with things like that. And maybe a small audio book might be a way of making that happen. Some comments from you guys on that perspective.
Okay, can I go first?
Please.
At the launch, we were thinking, Komal Gasheke, if you can translate the book into Kiswahili, I think it will be a good thing, more so for our residents or for those, for the part of the population that maybe they don't understand, for those who don't understand English. We thought that it would be better if we did it in Swahili first and then maybe start distributing the book maybe in the local primary and secondary schools, and also even to the community members there. We also have groups in Madare, youth groups and maybe women's self-help groups. So I think this will be a good idea if we can translate in Swahili first. And then maybe now we can all start thinking on if we can translate it into Sheng and Shengateng. I think maybe, it will help to spread the message. Yeah, we can look on that direction too with time.
Kaseke.
Thank you very much. I think, as Comrade Feroza said, language is very important and is also a tool for liberation. As Yusuf Hassan, who was in the book launch, also spoke very strongly about Ngugi wa Thiong'o and the role of language in liberation struggle. So I think the idea of also translating the book of Gathanga in Sheng will be very important. I agree with Faith Kasina because they are Sheng, because they are more radical. Is different from people of Madare. Maybe Madare, they need to learn more from Kayole because he's the heart of the women resistance at the moment, I think. So, but if just imagine, Faith, we have this book in Sheng, even if it's not the old translation, but we have some small booklet in Sheng that speak about the resistance of the people, because there's a lot of struggle and marginalized struggle that we may not see, but the younger people are facing now, especially below 20 years to below 14. And they are not able to transmit this struggle in their language to the mainstream. I think it's a great idea that we can think about. There is the Gathanga, as he spoke, there is a new Sheng that is in the streets, but me, I can't speak it, but you, because you're a bit younger than me, you can speak it, like Nakulombo, but I don't know about that kind of language. So, and I know Faith is smiling because, you know, this language is there. What if we have Faith Kasina as one of the first women to organize a social justice center, writing a book in Sheng? It will be very powerful. What inspired you? And I think Gathanga has sparked a very powerful conversation. But if it is codified in English Victorian language, how many people will read it? I think we need to think about that. And I'm happy that Comrade Yusuf Hassan was inspired to help this kind of small booklet to translate them in different languages, especially starting with Swahili. But let's think about Sheng. What if we have books written in that language, but also have the same subculture of Kayole people? Just imagine how many young people we can mobilize who are being a victim of extrajudicial killing, being destroyed by crime and drugs. We need these young people as a social force in movement building. What cut us from them is lack of connecting language. There was a proposal there, and I hope Daraja Press also is partnering in this, that Gathanga needed to take his book to the local primary school in Madare, because many people felt it was very powerful and have a powerful history about Madare that many people don't know. And the young people are proposing, how is Gathanga move on in the local primary school and secondary school, giving his book as a gift and sharing about his history from Madare and learning from the informal school. And now he's a graduate and writing about the history of Madare. So I think Comrade Feroz is a very powerful idea about language. And Ngugi wa Thiong'o has spoken about it for a long, long time, that we need to decolonize ourselves. So it is powerful. And I, as Faith say, let's try doing the first with Swahili, but I would be happy to see Gathanga book in Kayole Sheng version.
So, Faith, Kayole Sheng, are you up to it?
If you want, when you're taking the book to the people in the community, we need to translate it in the language that they can understand. And the fact that most people in that room, when we were launching that book, said they were not proud of Mathare at all, the place where they come from, is actually, if this book can actually be translated in a language that they can understand and read it and understand it, then they would understand that Mathare is a place of hope, a place where struggle has started, and they would start being proud of it. So for me is, yes, we should translate it in a language that people understand. And we can take the challenge and translate it in our very complicated Sheng, because the Kayole one is very complicated. But yeah, that would be very beautiful, that young people would start embracing and appreciating the places where they come from, instead of us thinking as them as mere ghettos, as mere slums, as mere informal settlements, but being proud of them as our homes and places that you've grown up in. Yes, so that would be very, very beautiful. And it would be also an avenue of us to mobilize young people to join the movement.
Okay, so last words, Wairimu.
I hope everyone gets to read this book. And I hope you guys at Daraja help Gathanga distribute the book to these primary and secondary schools. It's very important. And I have literally not seen any other documentation of Mathare that's so thorough and detailed. Yeah.
Gathanga?
Thank you. I think we need to retell our story as Mathare. We need to take this story as far as possible. Because growing up, Mathare was a source of shame for me. I went to my high school first. I couldn't say I came from Mathare because I was ashamed of the place that I grew up in, because it was a slum, all this, fighting all this inequalities and injustice. But now Mathare has a new definition for me, and it's a story of community resilience and community resistance. And that has stood out for me, and that will be now my new definition for the people of Mathare. And then please, I can touch on the story of that we authored with Beth Kasina. As I finished, I told them the police reform and the unreformable police force, because we felt that Mathare is surrounded by a lot of police stations, and these police stations are not there to give us security, but they've been there to oppress us and to always intimidate us into submission. But we need to change that narrative, and the people of Mathare who can do that, and that's why we have to fight the system and maybe change the status quo. And there's one thing, there have been few things that have been happening with now the current regime led by Ruto. I think today the IPOA was summoned by the president himself, and he wants to know their mandate and role in keeping the police in check. And I think I think it's a good signal from the president. And also, just like a week ago, we saw that the special service unit, which was involved in a lot of extrajudicial killing, was disbanded, which I think it's a good direction as we go on converting our police force into a police service. Thank you.
All right, good. Well, I think end with a couple of comments. I think this book is really important because it has enabled people to be proud of Mathare, of the informal settlements that where most of our people live. And you do so not by romanticizing a place, but celebrating the struggle. And I think that's what defines people, not their identity, but their capacity to fight for freedom. And it's that reason that we are really proud at Daraja to be able to publish books such as these that gives real voice to real people and that celebrates and the struggles that we've taken place, not just victories, but the defeats, because we learn from defeats too. And so I want to congratulate all of you and the Organic Intellectuals Network for what you're doing. And I'm really proud. And if any way that Daraja can be of help, you have only to get in touch. So I send you warm greetings of solidarity and thank you for joining us on this show today. I'll just put up the picture of the front cover of the book and end by saying thank you, Asante Sana, Asanteni, and we will be in touch again soon.
Thank you very much.
Asante Sana, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Been listening to Feroz Manji in conversation with various people about the book Matare, an Urban Bastion of Anti-Oppression Struggle in Kenya. Not various people, various, well, they are people, but contributors to the book, to be more specific. So Feroz will be back with you in a month. But now, just as a final little wrap-up to the show, Doug?
Well, World Cup is on, and last Friday before it started, I had a good chat with Fareed Abdulhamid about the geopolitical implications of playing in Qatar and what all that big bucks means. Stay tuned to that piece.
Well, Fareed, you and I have talked soccer and football before, and so this particular round, Africa is represented. There's only five teams from the continent. Starting on the west coast, we have Cameroon, Ghana, and Senegal, and from the north, Morocco and Tunisia. There's lots to be discussed about that as a phenomena. We're happy to see them there, and we wish them well in their ventures. But at this point, before the games have started, there's some real concerns about the whole business of football, FIFA, and in particular the fact that the Gulf states have imposed themselves in such a funny way. Where should we start in understanding what's wrong with going to Qatar for football, soccer?
Yeah, it's all about sports washing of what's happening in Qatar. Like human rights, it's human rights records. It's terrible, like having a monarchy that is unelected, and where there is lack of democracy, there are human rights abuses, especially directed at migrant workers. Like as a Guardian article recently pointed that since the awarding of the World Cup hosting rights to Qatar in 2010, the last 11 years, 6,500 migrant workers have died. And this is because of lack of labor rights and labor standards. Most of them, they work in extreme heat. And many of them, as we understand, they work long hours in extreme heat, and many have died from cardiac arrest and other kind of illnesses. But because the Gulf countries have been powering billions of dollars into the European football leagues in places like UK, where they are buying big clubs like Manchester City, Newcastle, and more, or Paris Saint-Germain in France, we see Emirati and Qatari billionaires and members of the royal family buying clubs and pumping billions of dollars, not only in clubs, but also in advertising, in marketing, in TV rights, and also in naming rights. You'll see something like Etihad Stadium in Manchester City, Emirates Stadium. Admittedly, my own club, Arsenal, is the naming rights Emirates belongs to the Emirates Airlines, and you'll see a lot of clubs donning the same attire, like this brand, Emirates, Qatar Foundation, Qatar Airways, Etihad. So there's billions of dollars of money now being pumped into European football. And then the same countries that are doing the sports washing, it's not only in football, we also see in Formula One racing, which is a multi-billion dollar industry now, has Formula One races in places like Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, and Bahrain. More and more, it has been used also as sports washing as well. But these countries, as you know, Gulf countries, are close allies of Western countries like UK, France, and the US. Actually, when Qatar won the hosting rights of the World Cup in 2010, it was heavily backed by Sarkozy, former French president, to ensure that the World Cup goes to Qatar. And then it was not an accident that when Qatar was awarded the hosting right in 2010, right away in 2011, Qatari sports investment, a very big company, bought Paris Saint-Germain of the biggest French club in France. So it was part of the agreement that France will support Qatar, Qatar will invest in French football. There was a meeting, a secret meeting between Sarkozy and the organizers of the Qatari World Cup and former UEFA football president Michel Platini. And in that deal, it was agreed that France will push for Qatar to be granted the World Cup, but in turn, Qataris will invest in French football. And also in French television, BN Sports France.
Yeah. So where there's great wealth, there's great corruption. And we expect something like wealthy countries to get involved in a rich man's sport like F1. But there's going to be an impact on soccer if we let this go on like this.
Well, yes, soccer, as we know.
It was a poor people's sport. Anybody could do it.
Yes, it's as a working class roots, community roots. And most of the greatest football soccer players, they came from a working class background, whether it is Diego Maradona, Pelé, Ronaldo, so many of them, and many African, also greatest players from Africa, like Samuel Eto'o, Didier Drogba, Sadio Mane of Senegal, all of them are from a poor working class background. So this game sport has its roots in the working class community, but now football clubs are being transformed into something else. If you look like a club like Real Madrid, Barcelona, Chelsea, Manchester United, we can't call them clubs anymore. These are actually corporations. Billions of dollars circulating in this so-called sports club that actually function corporations that are making millions from TV rights, from advertising, from the sale of merchandise. And we see only the clubs owned by the rich and the mighty are the ones that can win the biggest titles in Europe in the Champions League. Before, we had small clubs in Europe, before there was this heavily commercialization of football in Europe, we had small clubs from like places like the Netherlands, clubs like Ajax, PSV, winning European club championship, clubs like Benfica and FC Porto from Portugal winning these European club titles, even clubs like Steaua Bucharest from Romania, and the former Yugoslavia had a club called Red Star Belgrade. All these clubs won the European club championship at one point, but not anymore.
They can't compete.
They can't compete with the multi-billion dollar funded big clubs. They can't compete. So the football glory has been monopolized by big money. So big money is destroying the football game. Actually, former manager of Arsenal, Arsene Wenger, he said it many times that big money is trying to support. He called for what he for financial fair play, which means that there has to be control of infiltration of big money into football, to allow for smaller clubs, smaller communities, smaller clubs to have a fair share of competition in local European leagues, but also in international football. And because of also big money, Africa is losing a lot of talent to Europe. We see an exodus of so many players from the African continent who are being signed up with big clubs in Europe. They spend most of their time in Europe, but when they go to World Cup, bringing these players together again, it is very difficult to have a cohesion because men are playing in different leagues, in different places. So it's affecting African football in a way. So that is the challenge with sports washing and big money taking over sports, especially football now in Europe and elsewhere.
Well, thanks for that oversight. I'm really torn about watching anything in Qatar, but of course my soccer instinct takes over and I want to see Senegal beat those guys when they start the game in Tuesday.
Oh, yes, especially on Monday, Senegal plays Netherlands, 11 a.m.
Whoa, that'll be a hot one.
That will be on the TSN. Don't miss on that one. And then I think on Tuesday, also on TSN, 8 a.m., Tunisia plays Denmark. And then on Wednesday, Morocco plays Croatia. And then Cameroon will play their opening game against Switzerland on Thursday, next Thursday. And Ghana will play Portugal next Thursday as well. So we
will have 4 days of African hockey. Shut down the city. We're not going anywhere.
But also, we only have five teams, which is unfair. Africa should have at least 8 to 10 teams at the World Cup.
Yes. Yes.
Because FIFA is limiting African participation deliberately at the World Cup because they don't want an African country to win the World Cup. Europe has almost half of the teams that are going to play in the World Cup. Almost
again,
half of the
money. There's no investment in African soccer compared to Europe.
Yeah. Yes. So they are limiting the number of African teams that are going to play at the World Cup. We have a lot of great African teams that didn't make it, teams like Egypt, Nigeria, Ivory Coast, Algeria. They are not in the World Cup because Africa has very limited slots at the World Cup. So when they play the qualifiers, only five can go. The other big African nations are always left out. And another problem we have at the World Cup is officiating. They pretend to be professional, but we have seen many times that African teams are at the receiving end of the officiating because football is driven by money. Which means they want the bigger teams like France, Germany, and England to go far to the quarterfinal, semifinal, and the final because there is a big TV audience in Europe. There's a lot of TV rights in Europe, like billions are spent on TV and advertising in football in Europe. So money is driving the direction of football. It's controlling the officiating, it's controlling everything. So there's a lot of unfairness and injustice in football.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Freddie. What a great analysis. We'll be watching it closely and we'll come back in the later days of the contest to reflect on Africa and what's happened throughout the contest.
Okay. So, one last note. Also, the World Cup is coming to North America in 2026. It will be played in Canada, US, and Mexico co-hosting. But I believe that a country like US, UK, and France, these countries should be banned from hosting the World Cup because of their human rights record. There shouldn't be double standards. Of course, we should shed light on what's happening in the Gulf countries, but a country like US, UK, or France will not be hosting World Cup given their military interventions in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, and the ongoing human rights violations that they're causing around the world. So it should cut both ways. So we should need, when the World Cup comes around here in North America, we need to raise that one to make noise as well.
What's good for the goose is good for the gander.
Yes, exactly.
Thanks again, Fareed. We'll talk soon.
Okay, thank you, Dad. Thank you very much. You have a good day.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Pick up the tree, decorate the tree, make a gift list, invite the in-laws, drop off the canned goods, find that fruitcake recipe for the office party, plan the dinner for Christmas Eve, decorate the house, hang the stockings, wrap the presents, ask Lucas to clean up his room, do the groceries, bake cookies. Right. Go get vaccinated.
The holidays are fast approaching. Get vaccinated against COVID-19 now so you'll be protected in time. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Oh, masikini, mimi nina bala sana. Tabu ni nyingi, zinazo nikabili mie. Nitafanya nini o, ulimwengu. Niwe na maisha, kama wenzangu. Nitafanya nini o, ulimwengu. Na maisha kama wenzangu. Bala sana tabu ni nyingi zinazo nikabili mie nitafanya nini o ulimwengu niwe na maisha kama wenzangu nitafanya nini o ulimwengu niwe na maisha kama wenzangu.
Join Cinema Politica for our fall screening series. Monday, November 21st, Primera, a film on the Chilean uprising. Monday, November 28th, The Clabona Keepers, looking at indigenous land and water defenders on the west coast of Turtle Island. Monday, December 5th, Into the Weeds, a celebrated documentary that looks at the struggle against multinational pesticide company Monsanto. These films show on Mondays at 7 p.m. in room H110 at Concordia University, 1455 de Maisonneuve West, Metro Guy Concordia. Info, cinemapolitica.org. These screenings are a CKUT radio co-presentation.
Well, that's it, ladies and gentlemen, for Amanda Radio this week at CQUT 90.3 here in Montreal. I'm Doug Miller, and I've been here with Fareed Abdulhamid talking about soccer. And we thank Firoz Manji from the Raja Press for his contribution with the Matari site of resistance to oppression. We will be back again next week with another longer piece by Fareed about the Ukraine and the implications for Africa of NATO's work in the Ukraine. So stay tuned now for Jazz Euphorium.